Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Ask the experts about free fitting on all our kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
It's that premium ice cream that many of you will see in the supermarket freezer aisle, Ben & Jerry's, and the brand is known for taking public political stances, and it's exactly that which has brought it into the news recently, because the co-founder, Jerry Greenfield, is leaving the company in a row with its owner after the ice cream brand said it would stop selling its ice cream in the occupied Palestinian territories. Well, to tell us more about this, we're joined by Adam Maguire from the RTE Business Desk. Hello, Adam.
How are you?
Very well, and very interested to hear this story because it's fascinating. But we want to go right back to where it all began, where Ben and Jerry started, the mid-1970s.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and the first surprising thing is it was a bit of an accident because Ben and Jerry's wasn't really meant to be an ice cream company at all. So we have Ben Cohn and Jerry Greenfield. They were old school friends. They had tried and failed at a number of their own ventures. Cohn initially was trying to sell pottery. Greenfield wanted to go into medicine, but didn't manage to do that. But by their kind of mid to late 20s, they had decided that maybe we'll try and set up some kind of company ourselves and see how that goes on instead. So they incorporated Ben & Jerry's in 1977. Initially, the plan was to sell bagels. That was going to be the business, not ice cream, no interest in ice cream. But they realised that the equipment to make bagels was very expensive, so they started scratching around for something else to do. They found a one-week ice cream making course at Penn State, which is still going, actually. It cost them $5 to sign up to it. So they did that, took the money that they had, bought an old petrol station, and they started selling ice cream. But because it was in Vermont, which isn't always the warmest place in the world, they also started selling crepes and soups. Those things, though, disappeared quite quickly. And
nobody wanted the
focus,
the crepes.
No, it was the ice cream that people were interested in.
And that took off really quickly then.
Yeah, really incredibly fast. So, as I say, they incorporated in 77, set up the shop in 78. By 79, they were already selling wholesale. So
Very quick.
Yeah, really, really quickly. You could pick up a tub then in a supermarket rather than having to go to their scoop shop. By 85, so pretty much 7 years after establishing, they had revenues of $10 million at the equivalent of around $30 million today, and still a relatively small business compared to what they became. And I suppose part of that was because they were just lucky. I said they stumbled into ice cream, and they did it at a time when there was this expanding sector of the premium or the ultra premium ice cream market. So, you know, when they launched in the 70s, it was a tiny part of the ice cream industry. It was all very kind of basic stuff. Whatever sales there were all going to Häagen-Dazs, which, despite what the name suggests, was actually set up in the Bronx in the 60s. It's not Scandinavian at all. And the differences between it and Ben & Jerry's are really kind of stark, because, you know, Häagen-Dazs was projecting this image of kind of refinement and luxury, and that's how it justified its higher price. Ben & Jerry's, though, kind of leaned into a more, you know, homemade, wholesome and kind of irreverent image. You know, the tubs had pictures of Ben & Jerry on the lid. The logo was a kind of basic hand-drawn man making ice cream. And then, of course, they started with the novelty names, the, you know, Jerry Garcia, named after the frontman of the Grateful Dead. And all of that kind of just endeared them to customers. But so too did the flavours, because, you know, they were kind of really stand out compared to what was on the market at the time. And again, this was kind of a bit of happenstance. It wasn't really part of the plan. Ben Cohn suffers from anosmia, so he has a very poor sense of smell, which in turn means he has a poor sense of taste. So to counter that, they said, we're going to make them really strong flavours, and we're going to put textures in there as well, so that there's a bit of enjoyment even if you can't really taste it. That's why Ben & Jerry's ice cream have all the lumps and bits and pieces in there, which is kind of a feature of the brand now.
It's such a strong brand, though, even still, because when my children are trying to blackmail me, that's what they'll ask for.
Right, okay.
You know,
yeah.
It's still out there,
it's
isn't
still,
it?
Yeah, it's still iconic, really.
So then the activism, when did that become part of the business?
Yeah, it was always there to some degree, I suppose, you know, starting with their policy around how they treated their employees, you know, good terms and conditions, and linking their income to the average salaries in the company as well. But it kind of became broader and more formalized then within the business in the mid 80s. They started to decide, you know, to raise money for the business through an expansion, through the sale of shares. And this is kind of the first real sign of how serious they were taking this kind of society and kind of activism. Usually when you're selling shares in your business, you go to venture capital firms, you go to institutional investors and see if they want to buy a piece. But they opted to limit the sale to Vermont residents. So people in the the local area from where the business was based, kind of an attempt to keep it in the hands of the local community. They then set up a foundation using some of the share sales. They committed 7.5% of annual profits towards it, and that would all go to community initiatives as well. And then it really builds then in the 90s. They start kind of becoming very vocal campaigners on children's rights, campaigning against the use of genetically engineered hormones in cattle. They then broaden out into campaigns around climate change, emissions, very vocal on LGBTQ plus matters and the likes of marriage equality, and then racial inequality over the years as well. So it really becomes a very broad kind of campaign mm-hmm. that they build around these issues.
So that then leads to the next big question. Like, Unilever doesn't fit with this image.
Not really, no.
When did they become involved?
So they swooped in to acquire Ben & Jerry's in 2000, paying $326 million for the firm. So a lot of money even now, but especially 25 years ago. And I suppose for Unilever, the deal made sense. You know, here we had, as you say, this, you know, still very strong global brand, recognised market-leading premium brand, revenues in hundreds of millions, a great reputation, loyal customers, all kind of ticking those boxes. And then, so if you take that and you bundle it in with your existing ice cream brands, they own HB and Walls and Magnum, then you kind of squeeze a lot of efficiencies out of the model as well. So it's very good for business. But
it's very corporate, isn't it? Coming from such rustic beginnings.
And it is the exact opposite. And it really raised a lot of eyebrows for Ben & Jerry's because, you know, by rowing in with this big corporation, you're jeopardising that wholesome homemade image that took 20 years to cultivate. Clearly, they were going to kind of struggle to paint themselves as the underdog, fighting the good fight against the big guys, you know. And people also wondered, well, will they be able to continue this activism and social messaging? Because, you know, mega corporations like Unilever tend to shy away from that kind of stuff. They lobby quietly about what they want, but they don't take political stances publicly, certainly not, you know, arguing with the government of the day in the way that Ben & Jerry's did. So many felt like this was kind of incompatible from the get-go. And even Ben & Jerry didn't seem too keen on it. In a statement following the deal, like literally the statement they put out welcoming the deal in inverted commas, Ben Cohen said they would have preferred for the company to stay independent, but he was excited about the next chapter at the same time.
So why did they agree to it then, to be bought by Unilever?
Well, this is the risk when you invite in shareholders, when you list yourself on the stock exchange.
Got no choice.
Yeah, pretty much. Like it tends to be irresistible for companies once they reach a certain size. Generally, it's seen as the best way to get money to help grow the business. But once you bring shareholders in, you're obliged to serve their interests, essentially. And you don't really have a say on who those shareholders are. You know, it means that, you know, you're depending on how much of the company you float and the shares that you offer, there's a chance you're going to have someone come along who doesn't share your vision or your priorities. And they could become a major shareholder and you have to listen to them, or they could take over the business altogether, which is what happened here. You know, and while Ben & Jerry's was a success in most people's eyes, it wasn't a particularly well-performing stock in the 90s. And that opens the door for a bigger player to come in and snap it up. And at the time of the acquisition, they were actually talking to a number of different potential suitors. In the end, Unilever was kind of the best of the bad bunch for them. Wasn't solely based on the money, but obviously that was an important factor, especially when you're trying to keep your shareholders happy. It was also down to the fact that Unilever convinced Cohen and Greenfield they were keen to improve their environmental record. So they were kind of saying to them, look, here's a chance to come and change a massive company in the way we do business, which would be even more important. Unilever also promised, and this is kind of key to what's happening now, to keep Ben & Jerry's as a separate entity within the group. It would have its own board and structure. And they said they'd be allowed to focus on whatever social issues they wanted. They wouldn't have influence from head office. And Unilever would also commit to keep giving money to the foundation, which would go towards the kind of charities that they wanted to fund as well.
Mm, so we won't interfere is what they said. But then tensions at some stage, obviously, between Unilever and Ben & Jerry's began to grow. When was that?
Yeah, so it was actually a relatively peaceful 20 years. It was only really at the start of the 2020s that things became kind of heat between two sides. And like in that time, Ben & Jerry's were taking stances on, you know, marriage equality, climate change, Black Lives Matters, and it all seemed to be okay. But the first real sign of trouble was in 2021. Ben & Jerry's announced it would stop selling ice creams in the occupied Palestinian territories. That was opposed by Unilever. And while technically the merger deal meant it was a decision for Ben & Jerry's, Unilever then showed, well, we still have power over you. So what they did was they sold the Israeli business to a local Israeli company, the brand and the recipe and everything. And they basically said, well, it's not your decision anymore. They took it out of Ben & Jerry's hands. It sparked a lawsuit between the two, and that was settled in 2022, the terms of which were private. Though.
But that certainly wasn't the end of it, right?
No. It's really kind of escalated from that point. So, I say Ben & Jerry sued in 2022, settled. They launched a suit again last year saying that Unilever breached the terms of that 20, 2022 agreement because they blocked it from speaking out about Gaza, including they claimed attempts. They wanted to call for a ceasefire. They wanted to show support for US students protesting the war. They wanted to call for the US to stop giving military aid to Israel, and Unilever blocked all of those things. They're also said to have tried to criticize Donald Trump a number of times, but were blocked from doing that as well. Then it really picked up pace this year. In March, Unilever sacked Ben & Jerry's CEO David Sever. The ice cream brand said it was due to his social activism. Unilever, though, said no, it was nothing to do with that. It was kind of a business decision. Then in April, Unilever announced it was going to audit the company's charitable arm, the Ben & Jerry's Foundation, to see how it's spending its money, which is money that Unilever ultimately is providing. And the focus here seems to be on a group called the Oakland Institute, which has been critical of Israel and the World Bank, and it's been in receipt of funding from the foundation. And again, this is kind of seen as Unilever trying to influence in one way or another the activism the company engaged in. And I say it comes after 20 years of relative peace, but I suppose there's a feeling within Ben & Jerry's and Unilever's critics in general that the corporation was kind of happy to leave them away, especially when the political winds were blowing in favour of issues like marriage equality and so on. But we've in recent years had the rise of the culture wars, the risk of boycotts and the risk of that spreading to the wider business. And then, of course, the return of Donald Trump to the White House. And he's shown a willingness to punish companies that disagree with him or don't go along with what he wants them to do in terms of, you know, diversity and inclusion policies and so on. So there's now a real risk to a brand being vocal like this and that impacting Unilever as a whole company. And that's why now they're suddenly showing more of an interest in kind of squashing what Ben & Jerry's
so
are saying.
So Unilever got windy about the deal that they struck when they took the company over, and they said, you can do what you want, we'll own you, but we won't.
Yeah.
We won't influence what you try to do on
exactly,
the activism
yeah.
side. And is there any hope of a resolution then, Adam?
Well, Ben Cohen did recently say that they had sought to buy back the brand from Unilever for a price of between $1.5 and $2.5 billion, but Unilever rejected that. Part of the reason, and maybe this is the kind of silver lining for them, is that Unilever is actually in the middle of breaking off its ice cream brand from the broader business losing Ben & Jerry's from that company. It's going to be called the Magnum Ice Cream Company. Would make it less valuable. So they wanted to hold on. They didn't want to sell it off before that. At the same time, keeping Ben & Jerry's from having, you know, all of this heat brought on them in terms of their political activism and so on would also have damaged the brand. So that's probably part of the reason why they've been particularly keen to kind of quash that at the moment. So maybe the glimmer of hope here in this is that, you know, because they'll soon be part of a smaller company from November, they'll be part of a smaller company. They might have a better chance of being able to take their stances. It won't impact, you know, Unilever as a whole. At the same time, they might also draw in a new owner who isn't as afraid of kind of political controversy. That being said, when you're dealing in billions, they tend to not be wanting to be too political active
yeah,
like this.
Yeah, and just with the political climate in the States at the moment, it might be difficult to find
that owner. Exactly, yeah. I suppose maybe there might now be a better chance that they'll get that deal, though, that they'll be able to break away from the company and set up on their own again. Again, you know, probably not likely in the near future, but maybe as a smaller business, they'll be more interested if they come with a good offer and say, look, you know, we have people who are willing to fund us breaking away and, you know, it's worth our while. So, you know, maybe a slightly better picture ahead, but as I said, it's clear that Unilever were to a degree trying to deal with this now to make the company more attractive when they split it off as well.
Adam, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Adam Maguire from the RTE Business Desk and author of The Bailout Babies, which is out in all good bookshops right now. Some news to bring you. We were talking about the case at Woolwich Crown Court in London. It was another hearing in the case of Leomog Ohanney, who's also known as also a part of NICAP, Machara, of course. Well, the case has just been thrown out by the chief magistrate sitting at Woolwich Crown Court in the last few minutes. This was following a technical error. This was the argument that his defence made about this technical error in the way that the charge against him was brought. So we've heard in the last few minutes that that charge is gone and the case has been thrown out. Now, I also want to let you know that on Monday, we'll have our parenting expert, Dr. David Coleman, with us. So if you have any questions for David, do get them into us now. You can email the programme todaycb@rte.ie. That's todaycb@rte.ie. We're going to do our very best to get all your questions to him on Monday. That's David Coleman, who will be with me here on the show. Next, the NFL hits Dublin. What to expect as the Minnesota Vikings take on the Pittsburgh Steelers in the Capital this weekend.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.